Good evening, folks. It's time for the Arizona Daily Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. I'm your reader, Bethany Williams. I'll be reading from the Tuesday, February 18th, 2025 edition. First, the weather at 5 o'clock p.m. on the 18th. The temperature is 51 degrees. Winds from the north around 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 15, and clear skies. Relative humidity 22%. The high earlier today was 52, and we're looking at a low of 22 going into Wednesday. Wednesday is going to be a little bit more cloudy. Southwest winds 5 to 9 miles per hour, and high 55 and a low of 25 Wednesday night. Thursday and Friday continue very similar, balmy and sunny with highs around 50 and lows around 20. Here are the headlines from today's Arizona Daily Sun. We have new research highlights scale of moon's canyons, and students march in support of immigrants. But the top story is sheriff remembered as a visionary leader. This is by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. Joe Richards, who served an unequaled 8 terms as Coconino County Sheriff from 1972 until 2004, died on February 6th. A cause of death has not been publicly disclosed. Bill Pribble and Jim Driscoll, the two sheriffs who followed Richards, both began their careers under his supervision. They remember Richards as a compassionate and forward-thinking leader who professionalized and modernized the sheriff's office, as well as a devoted father and husband. He was just a tremendous influence and a pretty iconic figure in law enforcement throughout the state, Driscoll said. 20 years on from Richards' retirement, Pribble noted, "A lot of people may not remember Joe or don't understand the true impact he had on the county in general and the sheriff's office especially. But Richards left an enduring legacy carried forward by his successors. Even the recently elected sheriff, Brett Axeland, entered the department when Richards was still in charge. I think all of us carry with us that relationship we had with Joe and the standards that he set," Pribble said. "He still walks the halls of that sheriff's office." Joe Donald Richards was born in Lubbock, Texas, on March 17, 1936. His family relocated to New Mexico in the late 1930s to escape the Dust Bowl, then headed west in 1942. Though they'd planned to go to California, they ended up settling in Belmont, where Richards' father worked for the Navajo Ordnance Depot, now Camp Navajo, and his mother supervised the post office. Richards attended elementary school and high school in Flagstaff, and he met his future wife, Marilyn, in a typing class. They married shortly after Richards' graduation and remained together for over 70 years. Marilyn Richards died in October of 2024. After working odd jobs and spending a few years delivering mail for the U.S. Postal Service, Richards joined the Coconino County Sheriff's Office in 1960. In later interviews, Richards would recall he'd been inspired by watching Sheriff J. Francis Perry investigate a shooting at his neighbor's house in 1946. Richards spent a decade working under Sheriff Cecil Richardson, along with short stints as a highway patrolman and investigator for the county attorney. In 1972, he ran for election to replace Richardson and won. At 36 years old, he was the youngest sheriff in the state. He remained at the helm for 32 years. Across the county, from Flagstaff to the ranches to the Navajo and Hopi reservations, Richards maintained strong personal relationships throughout his tenure. Pribble said, "I think that was probably the key to his long success." Pribble and Driscoll both credit Richards with modernizing the sheriff's office, introducing stricter policies and procedures, and making it a more professional organization. Joe kind of brought the sheriff's office from the 1800s into the 1900s, Pribble said. Richards attended the FBI Academy in the early 1970s and earned a bachelor's and master's degrees in police administration from Northern Arizona University. He was really a student of his profession, Pribble noted. Joe is one who was able to see where we needed to be going and how we needed to get there, Driscoll said, adding that Richards possessed a great ability to see the future and a tremendous political understanding of the county, as well as the politics within the state that would affect law enforcement. Among his accomplishments as a leader, Richards spearheaded the creation of a new jail facility, as well as the shared headquarters of Sheriff's Office and the Flagstaff Police Department, completed in 1999 and still in use today. Later, he pushed to build a new facility in the same complex for the Coconino County Sheriff's Office Search and Rescue Unit. Search and Rescue, both Driscoll and Pribble said, was one of Richard's passions, and throughout his career, he strove to improve the unit's capabilities. Joe was the search and rescue guru for all 15 counties, Driscoll said. Whether it was a plane crash, a lost hiker, or a mass casualty incident somewhere, Joe was the one that led the charge throughout the state on developing volunteer and law enforcement resources to be able to respond to those kinds of events. In a previous interview with the Arizona Daily Sun, Driscoll recalled that the office's search and rescue team was just a bunch of guys driving Jeeps when Richards took over. Today, the team has over 100 volunteers overseen by two CCSO coordinators, along with a broad range of equipment ready to deploy from the warehouse at the sheriff's headquarters that Richards helped build. Richards also helped institutionalize the collaboration between Coconino County SAR and the region's federal agencies, Driscoll added. What search and rescue is today is a direct result of what Joe Richards did 30, 40 years ago, Pribble explained. Beyond his accomplishments as an administrator, Richards was known for leading his deputies by example. In an editorial marking Richards' retirement, the Arizona Daily Sun wrote, "For hands-on dedication to enforcement of the law, it's hard to believe anyone will outdo Joe Richards. Whether it was a murder scene or a search and rescue command post or a standoff with a barricaded suspect, Richard got there early and stayed late, usually until the crisis was resolved." It was an attitude that extended even to simple things, such as making sure deputies stayed healthy and in shape. He pushed us to be physically fit, and Joe was kind of a fanatic when it came to his own physical fitness, Driscoll remembered. He set the example for all of us, and he did it throughout his entire 32 years there. His preference for leading from the front lasted all the way to the end of his career. In 2003, Richards led the recovery effort for the remains of Texas pastor Monty Price and his family after their plane crashed into Schultz Peak. In 2004, after he'd already announced his intent to retire, Richards personally talked down a man who had barricaded himself in a house. The multi-agency SWAT team was prepared to enter the house by force, but after a phone call to the man inside, Richards and the suspect met outside. Richards was unarmed and wore no bulletproof vest, the Daily Sun reported. He was able to convince the suspect to surrender peacefully. Whenever there was a high-profile incident, Driscoll said, Richards astutely navigated the accompanying tensions. You had to be very careful in how you dealt with other agencies, as well as how you dealt with the media and the families of people involved in those situations, Driscoll said. But Joe, he was the master at it. Everybody in our department learned from him at times and watched how he responded and conducted himself in those situations. His leadership style, Driscoll said, was very direct, but direct like a father. No nonsense, yet compassionate. There were a few times when he chewed me out a little bit. A number of times throughout my career, he admitted. But he did it like a father would do it, and I appreciate it greatly. That compassion was not limited to colleagues. Richards taught his subordinates to respect the dignity of everyone they encountered, Driscoll said. Whether it was the street drunk or the person in jail or whoever, he always talked about never taking someone's dignity away. His sense of compassion for people, I think, was just so basic to his core, Driscoll said. Inevitably, Richard's career had its low points, too. In 1982, Reserve Deputy John, known as Doc Jameson, was shot and killed on duty. It was a tragic, tragic event for us, because the man was a member of our department, and he was well admired throughout the community, Richards told the Daily Sun years later. Another deputy, James Michael Young, died in a shootout while serving an arrest warrant in 1983. The 1988 murder of a 9-year-old child, Jennifer Wilson, was the case that affected him most, Richards told the Daily Sun in 2004. It hit the heart of this community because everybody could identify with the loss of his child, he said. Richards credited his Christian faith for guiding him through such difficult times. It has been the rudder that has kept my life intact, he said. Pribble affirmed the importance of religion in Richard's life, saying, that was another cornerstone of who Joe was. Besides coping with tragedies, there were more prosaic problems. The new jail turned out to require more county funding than Richards anticipated. The sheriff's office struggled to retain deputies because of uncompetitive pay. And when Richards finally prepared to step down after 3 decades in charge, tensions over the imminent change of leadership boiled over into online sniping by CCSO employees and a brick thrown through the rear window of Pribble's car. The rift was an unfortunate and frustrating coda to a long career. Richards, when asked about the divisiveness growing in the sheriff's office, choked back tears and said, I'm upset by it, and I'm dismayed by it, the Daily Sun reported at the time. Though he helped mediate and defuse the tensions, it couldn't have been the finale that he anticipated. But Richards rewrote his own ending. 8 years after retiring, he returned to the force as a volunteer ranch patrol deputy. It was a perfect fit, Pribble said. He had a true love for the West and ranching, and he knew all of the ranchers personally and had worked with them for years. Richards would have made a good cowboy, Pribble added, recalling a horseback ride the two of them took together.
He tried to kill me one day, riding his horses up on the peaks, Pribble laughed. I'm not a real horseman. Joe was an accomplished horseman. He said, let's go up there. All of a sudden, instead of riding the horse, I'm leading the horse up this 40-degree slope.
Retirement also gave Richards more time to pursue his longtime hobby of painting. In 2007, he even organized his own art show, displaying his landscape paintings at Brandy's Restaurant and Bakery. I'm studying artists from about 1850 to 1950, he said at the time. That would include Maynard Dixon, Thomas Moran, W.R. Lee, Edgar Payne, and the group of artists over around Taos. And the conclusion of his career afforded him more time to spend with his wife, his 4 daughters, and his 9 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren. He had a deep love for his family, Pribble said. That was a huge, huge part of his life. Still, Richards was never far away if his successors wanted to talk. I think it was a large part of the reason I was able to be successful in my tenure as sheriff, Driscoll said. I just continued to learn from him. Even after he retired, I met with him frequently to discuss things. Reflecting on their time together, Pribble said Richards had been a mentor and a friend. He cared about people. I think that was the thing, Pribble said. He taught me so much. Driscoll fondly recalled the times when Richards would gather his close advisors for conversations about the proper course of action for the sheriff's office. We were kind of a family there, and we would sit around the table and have those discussions like a family would have, Driscoll said. I'll miss that, I think, more than anything. That was Sheriff Joe Richards, remembered as a visionary leader in Coconino County. New research highlights scale of moon's canyons. Also by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. Looking up at the moon in the night sky, it's difficult to grasp just how dramatic the topography of its surface really is. But for David Kring, the reality of that terrain isn't too hard to imagine. Kring is the principal scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute, LPI, in Houston, and divides his time between Houston and Flagstaff, where he also serves on the Board of Trustees for the Museum of Northern Arizona. His most recent publication focuses on two immense lunar canyons known as Valles Schrödinger and Valles Planck, and draws upon his lifelong experience with Northern Arizona's most famous natural feature to convey the scale of these faraway chasms. I love my river trips through the Grand Canyon, and I have to say I've known about these two canyons on the moon for a long time, Kring said. And every time I'm in the bottom of the Grand Canyon on the river, I look up at the canyon walls and I just mentally map onto that view the walls of these two canyons on the moon. Kring's paper, fittingly titled Grand Canyons on the Moon, was published on February 4th in the journal Nature Communications, with co-authors Danielle Callenborn and Gareth Collins. It's one component of ongoing research intended to lay the groundwork for future lunar exploration missions. Valles Schrödinger and Valles Planck radiate outward from the Schrödinger Impact Basin, a crater roughly 200 miles across that was created by an asteroid impact around 3.8 billion years ago. That basin, Kring said, is the single best place on the moon to study the largest number of highest priority science objectives. And while previous studies have focused on the Schrödinger crater itself, this new study offers a closer look at the debris that was ejected from the basin and the scientific opportunities that that generated, he explained. The debris flung up by the asteroid impact included two concentrated streams of rock that created clusters of overlapping craters as they fell back to the surface, collectively carving out the two canyons discussed in the paper. Valles Schrödinger and Valles Planck are just monsters, Kring said. They're akin to the Grand Canyon in scale, and actually a little bit bigger, around 170 miles long, up to 16 miles wide and over 2 miles deep in some places. The Grand Canyon is longer overall, but not as deep. Its maximum depth from the North Rim is 6,393 feet, about 1.2 miles. Unlike the Grand Canyon, which formed gradually over millions of years through slow processes of uplift and erosion, Valles Schrödinger and Valles Planck formed over a span of mere minutes, a rapid, violent process that uplifted older rocks and deposited them along the canyon rims, potentially allowing astronauts to collect samples of strata that would otherwise be buried miles deep. It was only relatively recently that researchers were able to understand the formation processes confidently behind these lunar canyons, Kring noted. We now have available spacecraft data to measure them properly and see them properly, he said. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, an unmanned spacecraft launched in 2009, has imaged them and provided detailed elevation data that allowed us to start making measurements, that allowed us in turn to begin calculating the impact cratering processes that produced them. Understanding the geologic history of potential lunar landing sites is critical for designing exploratory missions and guiding sample collection. You can land an astronaut on the surface, but if they do not understand the geology of that surface, then they're inevitably going to be collecting samples that will not be useful as some of the other samples at that site, Kring said. At Arizona's Meteor Crater, for example, 175 million metric tons of rock were excavated when that crater was produced. You have to understand the geology of that crater to know which rocks among those 175 million metric tons to collect, he explained. And few locations, if any, are as well suited as northern Arizona for such geological training.
The area around Flagstaff was key to preparation for NASA's Apollo missions and put a geological stamp on that program, Kring said. When he was initially recruited to the LPI from his previous position at the University of Arizona, Kring was tasked with reviewing potential sites to train future astronauts to walk on the surface of the moon. He considered all the past Apollo training sites, as well as other candidate sites across North America and the world. At the end of the day, Kring said, I recommended Flagstaff as the primary training and lunar mission simulation site. The training program that he helped develop included work at Meteor Crater, SP Crater, and the Black Point Lava Flow, all areas Kring is deeply familiar with. I've been taking PhD students up here since 1989, he noted. If all goes to plan for NASA's Artemis program, the first mission to return humans to the moon in over 50 years is scheduled for 2027. The program, however, has already experienced numerous delays. If and when astronauts do return to the lunar surface, Kring believes the samples they collect there could shed new light on the early history of the Earth. What people may not realize is the oldest epoch of Earth is gone. It's been eroded, it's been subducted by plate tectonics, he explained. Even at the Grand Canyon, you can go down and get to 1.7, 1.8 billion-year-old rocks. But what about those 4.2, 4.3 billion-year-old rocks? They've been consumed. On the moon, however, samples from that time period may still be accessible, and acquiring such samples, according to Kring, would be an extraordinary scientific triumph. That was the article, New Research Highlights Scale of Moon's Canyons. Northern Arizona University students march to Flagstaff City Hall in support of immigrants. Also by Sam McLaughlin. Around 100 Northern Arizona University students marched from campus to Flagstaff City Hall on Wednesday in protest of the anti-immigrant stance and policies of President Donald Trump and his administration. The demonstrators gathered at the University Union after 3 p.m., carrying signs with slogans such as No Human Being is Illegal, along with the national flags of Mexico and Colombia. The event was organized by NAU Somos, a self-described multicultural advocacy group on campus. After a brief announcement instructing attendees not to talk to police officers or engage with counter-protesters, the march moved out around 3:30 p.m. Marchers chanted, No fear, no raids, no ICE in our states as they walked, referring to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the branch of the Department of Homeland Security responsible for removal and deportation operations. Linking the U.S. border wall to Israel's treatment of the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Another refrain was, From Palestine to Mexico, all the walls have to go. The march proceeded slowly up San Francisco Street, pausing at all intersections. The Flagstaff Police Department had a highly visible presence ahead of and around the march, with at least 6 uniformed officers and civilian aides controlling vehicle traffic. Some of the chanted slogans became increasingly blunt as demonstrators moved northward. Yells of expletive Trump and expletive ICE and expletive the Border Patrol in Spanish resonated through the streets of downtown Flagstaff. The march paused for about 10 minutes at the corner of San Francisco Street and Birch Avenue, across from the county courthouse, where numerous passing cars honked to show support. There were no signs of any organized counter-protest activity. As the march was proceeding westward along Birch Avenue, however, a lone individual standing on LaRue Street, a white man wearing a white baseball cap, gave a Nazi salute and shouted, Heil Hitler, before running into the Old Town shops. It appeared that most of the protesters and police officers did not hear or notice him. The main body of demonstrators reached the lawn in front of Flagstaff City Hall around 4:45 p.m., where a smaller contingent had been waiting at the corner of Humphrey Street and Route 66. The protesters spread out along Route 66, waving signs and receiving more supportive honks from drivers. Four students who had followed the march from the beginning chose this moment to step away from the group, and two of them donned Make America Great Again hats. They played music from a small Bluetooth speaker, but the majority of the protesters ignored them. Eventually, the demonstrators all gathered beneath the flagpoles behind City Hall, where speakers shared stories about immigrant parents and grandparents, often mingling Spanish and English. They sacrificed everything they knew to provide a better life for their children, one speaker recounted. She also recalled meeting migrants from Central America near the border in Mexico. "This is a global issue," she said. Criticism of Trump was a common theme among the speeches. Arizona's senators, Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, were booed by the crowd when a speaker mentioned their votes in support of the recently passed Laken-Riley Act, which mandates detention and deportation of undocumented immigrants charged with nonviolent minor crimes. NAU President Jose Luis Cruz Rivera was also singled out for disapproval, with one speaker citing the university's aggressive response to last year's campus protests against the Israeli invasion of Gaza, and calling on Cruz Rivera to redeem himself by taking stronger action in support of minority students. "Aquí estamos y aquí nos quedamos," that speaker concluded. "We are here and we will stay here." Around 5:30 p.m., the speeches concluded, and organizers began playing Spanish-language music through their amplifier. Some protesters danced as the rest began to dissipate. That article was Students March in Support of Immigrants. That concludes the front page from the Arizona Daily Sun for Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been bringing the disabled audio access to print information for over 40 years. Learn how you can support us at sunsounds.org, where you can listen to our live streams or find individual episodes on demand. You can now also download our app to your Android or Apple device for free and listen to us there. In other local news, NAU earns R1 research designation by Daily Sun staff. Northern Arizona University, NAU, recently received R1 research activity designation, which is the highest classification for United States research institutions. The Carnegie Foundation announced the designation for NAU on Thursday, according to a university press release. According to the foundation's website, R1 schools have very high spending and doctorate production. A total of 187 institutions have been given this designation in 2025. The criteria for R1 status are spending at least $50 million on research and development, and awarding at least 70 research doctorates each year. NAU's announcement said the university has had year-over-year growth in federally funded research spending since it first exceeded the R1 expenditure total several years ago. Our R1 status recognizes transformative impact NAU's teacher-scholar faculty have in their fields, not only advancing cutting-edge research, but also providing exceptional educational experiences that prepare our students for dynamic, evolving careers in the modern workforce, said NAU President Jose Luis Cruz Rivera. NAU is ranked 192nd on a National Science Foundation table for research and development expenditures in fiscal year 23. Spending $70,533. The other two state public universities, U of Arizona and Arizona State University, are ranked 36th and 37th, respectively. NAU research includes wildfire management,
and recovery through the Ecological Restoration Institute, COVID and Valley Fever through the Pathogen and Microbiome Institute, and many other topics. The university's announcement said it has expanded its doctoral degree programs, which include informatics, curriculum, and instruction, and astronomy and planetary science. It added that the Office of the Vice President for Research has created graduate assistantships to support students working in priority areas for the ABOR Technology Research Initiative Fund. The research being done at NAU by our teacher scholars and students at every level is good for Arizona, the United States, and the world at large. We're taking on the challenges of health, technology, AI, and so much more, said Vice President for Research Jason Wilder. Opportunities for research at NAU help prepare our students for the workforce, especially in Arizona, as our economy is becoming increasingly technology-based. Our graduates are on the cutting edge of the tech that's moving the country and the world forward. This is the first year that the American Council on Education and the Carnegie Foundation are using an updated methodology to determine the designations. Between 2015 and 21, institutions had to award at least 20 research doctorates and spend at least $5 million on research and development a year. They were also evaluated on 10 variables, a principal component analysis, and two research activity indices. The current R1 designation requirements are $50 million in total research spending and 70 research doctorates a year. These updates to the Carnegie classifications are the first step to bringing a decades-old system into the 21st century. We are expanding our recognition of the range of ways colleges and universities engage in research and development, said Timothy F. C. Knowles, president of the Carnegie Foundation. And we are taking the guesswork out of what it takes to be recognized as an R1 institution. Over time, this will be good for the sector, for scholarship, for policymakers, and for students. In Arizona, ASU and U of A both received R1 designations for 2025. Dinant College and Midwestern University Glendale are classified as Research Colleges and Universities, RCU, a new designation for non-R1 or R2 universities that spend over $2.5 million on research each year. The new RCU designation identifies research happening at colleges and universities that historically have not been recognized for their research activity, including institutions that do not offer many or any doctoral degrees. ACE and the Carnegie Foundation plan to, publish two additional classifications in April of 2025, the updated institutional classification, and a new student access and earnings classification. More information can be found at carnegieclassifications.acenet.edu. That was NAU earns R1 research designation. Small plane crashes by Woody Mountain Road. No injuries reported by Daily Sun staff. A single-engine airplane carrying two people crash-landed in the vicinity of Woody Mountain Road on Sunday, February 16th, around 2:30 p.m. The pilot and passenger were uninjured and extricated themselves from the aircraft shortly before Coconino County Sheriff's deputies arrived on scene. According to a press release from CCSO, the pilot said the plane was en route from Laughlin, Nevada to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to be delivered to its new owner when an unspecified mechanical problem forced it down. The National Transportation Safety Board, which investigates all civil aviation accidents in the United States, will be responsible for determining the cause of the crash. Based on images of the crash site released by CCSO, the plane appeared to be a Cessna 210 Centurion,
a propeller-driven, high-wing aircraft with retractable landing gear, which did not appear to be deployed during the crash landing, and a capacity for up to 6 passengers. The Cessna 210 was manufactured from 1957 to 86 in numerous variants and was a popular model among civilian operators, as well as some national militaries in Central and South America. CCSO thanked the Flagstaff Fire Department, Flagstaff Fire Department, and Pulliam Airport Fire and Rescue Department for their assistance in responding to the incident. That was Small Plane Crash by Woody Mountain Road. New Year brings new business closures and openings around downtown Flagstaff by Daily Sun Staff. 3 businesses around downtown Flagstaff have closed their doors in recent months, with 2 of the spaces already filled, in addition to a 3rd newcomer and relocation to the east side. The most recent closure came on Sunday, February 2nd, as Planet Science announced a few days earlier it would be permanently closed at the end of the weekend. Opening in May of 2023, the shop at 109 North LaRue Street was backed and supported by Meteor Crater Enterprises, though the items carried in the shop differed from what could be found at the Meteor Crater gift shop. It has been a privilege to connect with all of you, whether you are a Flagstaff resident or just passing through. Thank you for your support, the closure announcement read. The announcement also directed customers to follow Meteor Crater for future science-related opportunities, with comments adding, the shop plans to keep an online present with its web store, and that some members of the team would also be continuing at Meteor Crater. Just around the corner at 23 East Aspen Avenue, Pita Pit's Flagstaff location had closed its doors after multiple decades on the corner of Aspen Avenue and San Francisco Street. Permanently closing this past December, Pita Pit will be replaced by Urban Pine Eatery, which will be under the same ownership as the nearby Juice Pub and Eatery. Urban Pine Eatery will join Baja Mar Seafood Cuisine as new restaurants along East Aspen Avenue facing Heritage Square. Baja Mar took over the space vacated by Matty G's Steak Burger at 6 East Aspen Avenue, which was also previously occupied by Monsoon Chinese Bistro and Sushi and the Market Bar and Kitchen in recent years. Back on North LaRue Street, just a block south from Planet Science, Insomnia Cookies will take over the space at 15 North LaRue Street, formerly occupied by Starlight Books. The chain, which sells cookies, brownies, and ice cream, has store hours typically running well past midnight. It opened its first storefront in 2006 and typically operates its more than 200 locations near universities around the country. Lastly, Ponderosa Pawn and Trading permanently closed its location at 118 West Route 66 and debuted its new storefront at 2300 North 4th Street on January 27th. Open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Saturday, Ponderosa Pawn and Trading posted the news of the move on January 8th. And that was New Year Brings New Business Closures and Openings. Here are some more shorts from around the town. NAH continues to add providers with hire of Brown by Daily Sun Staff. Northern Arizona Healthcare announced Monday, February 10th, that Derek Brown, DO, has joined its Flagstaff primary care office and is now accepting new patients. This addition is part of an ongoing expansion of primary care from NAH, which recently moved its primary care clinic to 1895 North Jasper Drive. NAH CEO Dave Cheney has said the group plans to double the number of providers in the clinic. Brown has over 15 years of medical experience and is board certified by the Osteopathic Board of Family Medicine. He has a medical degree from the Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine at Midwestern University and completed a family medicine and family medicine residency at the Pacific Hospital of Long Beach. According to the announcement, he takes a patient-centric approach to care. His care philosophy is to empower his patients to take charge of their health by working collaboratively with them to devise personalized preventative medicine strategies, the release said. NIH Medical Group President Pasquale Bernardi, MD, described Brown as passionate about sharing his knowledge with patients. We believe in the importance of delivering comprehensive primary care to the communities we serve, and the addition of Dr. Brown will provide more primary care options in the Flagstaff area, he said. More information can be found at nahealth.com/northern-arizona-healthcare-medical-group-flagstaff. Art submissions sought for Echo Cliffs Health Center. The Tuba City Regional Health Care Corporation, TCRHCC, is seeking art submissions for display in the Echo Hills Health Center in Broadway Gap. The Echo Cliffs Health Center is currently under construction, with an expected opening date late fall of this year. It will be about 125,000 square feet and 2 stories tall. Its outpatient services will include dental, eye care, primary care, mental health, podiatry, physical therapy, and pharmacy to residents who are currently traveling to Tuba City for health care. The center will also include Navajo Nation programs such as women, infants, and children, diabetes prevention, behavioral health, and health education. According to Tuesday's announcement, Echo Cliffs is seeking artwork that embodies local traditions, stories, and the beauty of the surrounding lands. Artwork can be submitted until 5 p.m. on February 27th of this year. Submissions must be original and created entirely by the artist, and can include various subjects, landscapes, portraits, and still lifes were listed as examples. They will be judged by artistic merit, creativity, and alignment with the health center's mission. This is an incredible opportunity for local artists to showcase their talent and be part of a space that serves and uplifts our community, said Julius Young II, Chief Operations Officer. The artwork will enhance the facility's environment, offering comfort and inspiration to patients, staff, and visitors. Submissions can be emailed to Krista, K-R-I-S-T-A, at 8180art.com, and must include a link or attachment to an image of the artwork in JPEG, PNG, GIF, or PDF format. The message should also include full name, phone number, and a brief description of the piece that lists the medium, dimensions, and title. Artists whose work is chosen must complete a purchase, donation, or loan agreement with TCRHCC, according to the announcement. Community memories sought for Southside Sculpture. The City of Flagstaff invites past and present residents of the Southside neighborhood, or others with a strong attachment to the area, to contribute memories and reflections for incorporation into an upcoming public art installment at the newly named Cleo Murdoch Park, which sits adjacent to the Murdoch Community Center on East Brannan Avenue. The planned sculpture, titled Russell, is intended, R-U-S-T-L-E, is intended to symbolize and celebrate both nature and the interconnected stories of the South Side, its history, and its people. Designed by metal sculptor and public artist Beth Nyback, the sculpture will have a leaf-like form, standing approximately 8 feet tall and constructed of weathering steel. Words and phrases contributed by the community will form much of the sculpture's surface. Jana Weldon, Program Manager for Beautification Arts and Sciences, said, "This sculpture will reflect the voices of the Southside community. We have prioritized neighborhood participation throughout the creative process to ensure that the artwork is truly communal. Nybeck's design was selected through a community-engaged process. Common themes from the selection panel and resident input included the importance of Southside history, the unity of the neighborhood, how the neighborhood is supportive of one another, equity and justice, multicultural experience, and embedded memories. Russell is a meaningful and impactful addition to Cleo Murdoch Park that residents, visitors, and future generations will be able to experience for many years, Weldon said. Community members can submit their memories through Connect Flagstaff at connect.flagstaffaz.gov/Southside Memories. Flagstaff's 2025 Beautification in Action Grants available. The City of Flagstaff is accepting applications for the biannual Beautification in Action Grants, awarded each year in March and September through the city's Beautification Arts and Sciences program. The grants support projects that enliven and revitalize the urban environment and are open to artists, community members, or groups, schools, and local businesses. Applications are open until March 15th at 5 p.m. Engaging Flagstaff in public art through locally driven initiatives is a highlight of Beautification Arts and Sciences, said Jana Weldon, program manager. These grants enhance our communities, enhance our communities and provide opportunities for emerging and established creatives of all kinds. Selected projects can receive up to $7,500 each. Past BIA grants have funded multiple murals, a pollinator garden, and vinyl art wraps for utility cabinets. Though the city is also currently soliciting separate applications for utility cabinet beautification. Potential projects can include, but are not limited to, community gardens, neighborhood paths, benches, and sculptures. Priority will be given to community-initiated projects that provide a lasting impact, fostering cultural connections, strengthening neighborhood awareness and identity, and deepening how residents and visitors interact with the built environment. All projects must be publicly and visually accessible. Funding for these grants comes from the city's bed, board, and beverage tax. For additional information or to apply, visit flagstaff.az.gov/4411. And that concludes the shorts. We didn't have any obituaries, so I'll move straight on to sports. Lumberjacks wipe out Hornets 75-60 with two early scoring runs in Flagstaff by Michaela O'Bannon, Sun Sports editor. After a powerful first half, the Northern Arizona basketball team, with a 21-6 record, 12-2 conference, handled Sacramento State 75-60 on Saturday at home in the Walk-Up Sky Dome. To start the first quarter, Northern Arizona went on an 18-0 scoring run for over 6 minutes, while Sacramento State went 0-for-13 in its field goal attempts during the outburst. The visitors ended the quarter going 2-for-16, 12.5% from the field, while Northern Arizona was 9-for-17. In addition, Sacramento State was 0-for-4 on three-point attempts. The opening quarter ended with a 17-point difference, 24-7. We knew that wasn't going to sustain, Lumberjacks head coach Lori Payne said. They were going to shoot better than 12%, and they have really good players to be able to do that. We needed to buckle down and play really solid defense, and I felt like we did that for the majority of the game. Sacramento State, with an 11-15 record, 4-9 conference, continued its cold shooting into the second quarter. It went 0-for-11 in field goal attempts, while Northern Arizona went on another 17-2 run for over 6 minutes. By halftime, Northern Arizona had shot out to a 45-21 lead. Northern Arizona had a 47% field goal percentage at the half compared to Sacramento State's 18%. The Lumberjacks were 6-for-32 in field goal attempts, while the Hornets were 7-for-38. We've talked about starting really strong, especially in that first quarter, and then starting really strong out the half. And those are things we haven't always been consistent with this season, Payne said. But I feel like the last few games we've been really, really solid at the start of both halves. Northern Arizona ended the day with a 37% field goal percentage. Overall, the team's shooting has improved since December, but will remain a priority during practice over the next 3 weeks, Payne said. In the last 8 games, Sacramento State has won just once against Idaho State. It is 7th in the conference, while Northern Arizona is 2nd. Sophie Glancy has been the top scorer for the Lumberjacks throughout the year. She earned her 14th double-double this season on Saturday, ending the day with 21 points and 11 rebounds. It was her 12th time this season she recorded more than 20 points in a game. There have been 27 games this season, meaning that Glancy has earned a double-double on average once every 2 games. "It's exciting for sure," Glancy said. "I think a double-double means I'm crashing the boards enough. So I think that's something I'm trying to make sure I'm doing for my teammates, getting to the O boards in defense, like getting box outs and stuff like that." Olivia Moran also had a double-double with 14 points and 10 rebounds, her 2nd double-double of the season and 4th in her career. Moran said, "Although this is her senior year with only 2 home games left, there was no special significance to earning another double-double. At the end of the day, I just want to win, so I think that's my mindset," Moran said. "I just want to come out and work hard and help my teammates out, too, with whatever I can." Naya Moran secured 8 points against Sacramento State, putting her at 1,167 in her career. That made her the 10th highest overall scorer in Northern Arizona's history, knocking off Julie Hanks, who played from 1983 to 86, who had 1,165. Glancy is the 7th all-time Northern Arizona scorer, with 1,305 points as a redshirt junior. "It's really fun to see the way they've grown and the way that our team has really come together," Payne said. "And I think we have a mission this year, very much. We have some unfinished business, and I think that is at the center of every day, the work that each of these players are putting in." Last year, Northern Arizona played Eastern Washington in the championship round of the Big Sky Conference Tournament and lost 73-64. Next week, the Lumberjacks travel to Idaho and Eastern Washington before closing out their regular season at the Walk-Up Sky Dome. There are 4 games left until the tournament in Boise, Idaho. And that was Lumberjacks Wipeout Hornets. Finally, London Zoo, by Karen London. Southern Stingrays in Brazil. Our family spent 3 weeks in Brazil over winter break, and every day felt like a highlight reel. We were ecstatic about kayaking on a lake, trying new foods, seeing more than 100 new species of birds, hiking to waterfalls, watching baby coatimundis in the forest, making and drinking caipirinhas, observing a sloth move at a speed that can only be described as actually kind of quickly, and body surfing during our all-day hike to 7 different beaches. It was hard to choose a favorite experience until we went snorkeling at the beach in Ubatuba. We were in clear, shallow water, so we had excellent views of everything we saw, including parrotfish, angelfish, butterflyfish, porcupine fish, and a green turtle. Best of all, we swam directly over about 30 stingrays, which was the highlight of all highlights. The southern stingrays were among the most plentiful fish, though it took some effort to see them because of their camouflage.
Their diamond-shaped body is flat overall, with a brown, olive, and gray dorsal surface and a pale ventral surface. Females measure up to 1.5 meters across, larger than males, who only reach a size of about 1/3 of a meter. The species of ray occurs from New Jersey to southern Brazil in the Atlantic Ocean, and also in the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico. Most of the ones we saw were motionless on the sea floor, blending in with the sandy bottom, and partially buried, but we did see a few of them swimming. As nocturnal predators, they're not very active during the day, which is when we were snorkeling. Even when they're not moving, it's possible to spot them if you search for their tail, as it doesn't blend in with the sand as the rest of their body does. They have a long, whip-like tail with a serrated, venomous barb near its base that can deliver a painful sting. They use this barb as a weapon to defend against potential predators, including hammerhead sharks and humans. But they are more likely to swim away to escape predators than to fight them. If the stinger is broken off, it will regrow, though it takes several months. When searching for food, southern stingrays disturb the substrate by flapping their fins or blowing water on the sand to reveal their prey, which include bivalves, crustaceans, worms, and small fish. They can also locate prey using their sense of smell, as well as with electroreceptors. Southern stingrays remain loyal to a site once they have set up a territory, which they defend from other individuals. They periodically visit cleaning stations where bluehead wrasse and Spanish hogfish remove and eat the trematode parasites from the ray's body, including from their gills. It's a mutualistic relationship in which both gain something. The rays benefit because they're cleaner and healthier, and the cleaner fishes benefit from the food they acquire. Snorkeling with southern stingrays was a standout memory among many outstanding ones from our travels in Brazil. That was the London Zoo. That's all the time I have for today's reading of the Arizona Daily Sun, from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams. Have a good night.
They invented a reason. That's why it stings. They don't think you matter because you don't have pretty rings. I keep telling you I don't care. I keep saying there's one thing they can't change. I'm your moon, you're my moon. We go round. Shuffle the numbers, watch them come and go. We're the ones who are out here, out past the edge of what they know. We can only be who we are. Doesn't matter if they don't understand. Said you